Okay, here we go. Getting into the retreat now. Day and a half has gone by. It's a time when the energies should start to be returning, start to feel that you're settling in. And as I mentioned on the yesterday, the three stages or the three levels at every stage of recognition, familiarity and comfort. You're recognizing the place, getting familiar with it, and you start to feel some comfort in the place, comfort in the routine, comfort in the food, your place to stay, getting into a nice routine of showers, brushing teeth, whatever, because that brings a sense of comfort. And once you get into this comfortable stage, then we can start sort of sharpening up the meditation by giving it a bit more direction. Now, the talks which I've given so far are always emphasizing the theme of the meditation, the underlying way meditation works. And you know, I keep on saying this, but it needs to be repeated. It is that deep letting go, that abandoning, that leaving things alone, you getting out of the way. And if you could understand that, you understand everything about meditation. Nevertheless, because it's a difficult thing to do, it does go against the grain. It just completely goes against the intuitive habits which you've built up over many lifetimes. So we do need some other skillful means, methods, to encourage a person to sort of let go. And we actually use just the way that the mind wants to set itself goals. It wants to put forth some effort, it wants to strive, it wants to do something. It knows what it wants to do, what it has to do. Because of that, that we do have these methods. But I will begin this talk by making that rider that the methods, the course, the plan, is just basically just to stop you making plans. The course there is not to get you to move somewhere else, but to keep you still where you are. So the whole program is really to teach you how to stop doing the programs. The whole purpose is to turn yourself off. In one of the similes for the meaning of life, which I think I usually tell every year at these retreats, and I remember this because it's a simile in my meditation book, which is coming out the end of this year, or August or September or something. Because I was told when I was a young monk in Thailand of a conversation piece which was being sold in California. It was one of these little things you put on your coffee table, and it became just an item to have. It became a fad. It became fashionable. And all it was a metal box with one switch on the outside. And usually you'd just sit it on your coffee table, and when somebody would come in and ask, what's that for? What is it? What's it doing on your coffee table? Your guest was invited to flip the switch, which they did. And once the switch had been turned on, some battery-operated cogwheels could be heard going around inside. Things were happening, things were moving, there was a rumble from inside the box. And then after a few seconds, a flap came out from the side of the box. And a hand came out, a mechanical hand came out from that flap. Turned around the corner, switched off the switch, went back inside, and the flap went down. It was a machine whose sole purpose was to turn itself off. And I thought, wow, what an amazing metaphor for life that is. The whole purpose of this meditation is actually basically to switch the doer off. Okay, so the doer has to switch itself off. So this is the problem here. Now find out how to switch yourself off. So if you think about switching off, this is the place to do it. But switching off big time. However, that is a hard thing for a person to do, so we trick them into switching themselves off gradually. So the whole purpose of meditation is switching things off. First of all, you switch off your family, your material possessions, your home. Then you switch off time. Then you so you switch off the body, so you just got left with the breath. Then you switch off the breath to get this beautiful nimitta. Then you switch off the nimitta to get into the mind. And slowly by slowly, you flip off all the switches of the mind as well, as things start to disappear. And as they disappear, it gets more real, more profound, and more blissful. And this is actually the bliss which takes you further and deeper in to switching off. If you understand what that is, you can understand that this path is a path of not doing rather than doing. That being said, that the Buddha actually did give you something, a little thing to hang on to at each stage, so you can completely let go. You hang on to one thing, a refined thing, as you let go of everything else. So it's the way of meditation which the Buddha taught above all was Anapanasati, which was meditation on the breath. And the first thing to say about Anapanasati is you have to distinguish Anapanasati from its almost twin brother called Anapanasati. Anapanasati is mindfulness of pain, not Anapanasati. And I say that because sometimes some people just sit down on the floor and they sit for hours. They're going to be tough. They're going to push through the pain. They're not going to give in. They're tough guys. They want to get enlightenment, not even by the end of the week, today. And you just get a lot of pain that way and suffering. And that's called Anapanasati. And many people actually follow that. And that's a lot different than Anapanasati. If you look at Anapanasati, if you put the I in it, it becomes Anapanasati. Just put an I in there and it gets Anapana. Now, come on, you can spell that. What that really means is when you get involved, the whole thing gets painful and a struggle. Which is the first point of this meditation technique. Don't push through pain. You just get a controller, you get very strong, but you get this controller, this freak business which just wants to push through one thing and it push through another thing afterwards. You don't fight the defilements of the mind, you understand them. Through understanding them, you overcome them. Not through force, because the force actually feeds those obstacles which block deep meditation. It's the understanding is what overcomes them. So the wisest people are not the strong, tough guys. The people who achieve things are not the tough guys, they're the wise guys. So be a wise guy, not a tough guy. Insight, wisdom, is always far more powerful than brute force. So if you have pain, just investigate first of all, what is that pain? And if you think that it's just something which is passing and not a big deal, you can just ignore it. If it's not a big deal, ignoring it will probably go away. It's just a little distraction, no more than that. But if it is something which doesn't go away, then if you just bear with it, it will probably get worse and worse and worse and worse. So the best thing to do is to move. The Buddha for 6 years sort of went on the path of asceticism, of trying to control his body through force, either through fasting, through stopping his breathing, all sorts of weird stuff which people did in those days. And there's always something about us which think, wow, if we're really tough, we're getting somewhere. And it's just the ego thing again. So, 6 years the Buddha found that's not the way. After those 6 years, he tried another way. He called it the middle way. He ate, he bathed, he slept. And his five friends, his first five disciples, abandoned the Buddha at this point, thinking that this fellow is now reverted to luxury. He's giving in, he's not fighting, struggling anymore. How can you get enlightened that way? But the Buddha did get enlightened that way. Too much force, too much pain, too much struggle is not the middle way. So if you have an ache or a pain in the body, the method which I use, which I teach, if that ache and pain comes up to disturb you, ignore it the first time and go back to your meditation object, such as the breath. If it comes up a second time, ignore it a second time. I usually ignore things 3 times because that's the way we do things in Buddhism, always 3s. And if it comes up the fourth time, and it just, you know, you can't just go back to the breath, the pain just keeps coming up, then let go of the breath and go to the irritation and be with it. See if you can understand it, not to control it, but just to be with it, to make peace with it, to understand it, to know it, not to try and get rid of it. That's important, just to be with it. And if, while you're just being with the pain, using that as your meditation object, the door of my heart's open to you, pain, I'm going to let go with you, pain, then if it just gets so bad that the thought comes up, I can't stand this any longer, resist that the first time. If it comes up a second time, look, I really have to move, it's too much. The second time that thought comes up, resist it. The third time, resist it. But the fourth time it comes up, I really can't stand this any longer, then move. That way, and sometimes those thoughts come up in quick succession, but it doesn't matter. If it's that strong, then move. And you don't need to sort of disturb the meditation by moving. When I get a pain in the knee or something, or the back during my meditation, it's just like I press the pause button. I'm not sort of going deep in the meditation, but I'm certainly not receding. And very carefully, very mindfully, I just move my legs. Now, instead of crossing the left leg over the right leg over the left leg, or sit in the Burmese position, whatever. And then, once I've changed the posture, very slowly with my eyes closed, I just go back to my meditation object and I take up the meditation exactly where I left off. I don't lose anything, except for the pain. So if you know how to change postures, or to have that little scratch, or blow the nose, or do that cough, you don't really hinder the path of meditation. In fact, you help it by getting rid of the strong obstacle of physical pain. So if you stay with the physical object of pain and you try and overcome it, that is called anapanasati. And it just leads to samadhi headache, to stress, and you're going in the wrong direction. Keep the body comfortable. Another word with the body, it's a strange thing, this body. I notice this so often, that if I sit meditation because I'm either tired or been very busy, you don't get into deep samadhi. After 1 hour there's something which will ache. I'm getting old now. However, you get into samadhi 2, 3, 4 hours and nothing aches at all after you come out. Sometimes this body, is it sort of because you sit long which causes aches and pains, or is it something else? If it really was the fact you sat long, and the longer you sat, the more stiff, the more aches, the more pain you should have, then getting into samadhi and sitting for 3, 4, 5 hours, you should be really in big trouble. But that's not the case. A lot of physical pain comes actually from the disturbance of the mind. But that's another thing altogether. We may leave that for another time. But just don't worry about time. Just get into the meditation. If you can get into deep meditation quickly, you won't feel the body, everything will relax and you will be fine. So the first thing in Anapanasati, the Buddha said to find a comfortable seat. So that's why it's great to have walls to lean against. I do apologize for the nature of these bricks. They're not smooth and sometimes you've got jagged bits poke out into your back if you lean against the wall. That's nothing to do with me. When we build our meditation center, we'll have the walls padded. So you have another meaning for a padded cell. You can lean against it, enjoy it. So, find a comfortable seat. A chair is fine. You can get great meditations on a chair. You can sit in your room, but please be careful of meditating flat out on your bed. I know that I call that sometimes flat, meditating flat out, but you'll find that the closer your head is to your pillow, the pillows are magnetic, and as soon as your head hits that pillow, you're not meditating anymore, you're sleeping. So if you do meditate in your room, just, you know, lean against the wall or something, sit on the floor, get a couple of cushions or blankets out to put under your bottom, but try not to sit on the bed. Or to, if you do lying down meditation, lie down on the floor, not on your bed, some different place. Because that will actually stop the mind thinking this is sleep time. And the second thing is to find a quiet place. And sometimes some dummies say you can go and meditate in the marketplace where it's really noisy, but you try that, you can try that years and years and years, you never get anywhere. You need a quiet place to begin with. Okay, when you've got some samadhi, when you've got strength in meditation, then you can meditate in the noisy places. But don't try and rush too fast. You find a quiet place. Which is why we ask people not to talk during this meditation retreat. Please keep that noble silence. And I'll bring your attention to see that image on the back wall over there. That image is there as a warning for you. That's what happened to the last person who broke the rules in this meditation center. That is only a joke. We never do things like that. But sometimes you get tempted when people talk in their rooms. So keep it quiet, because that noise is a disturbance to people's meditation. And it's really strange that sometimes the smallest of noises can be the biggest of irritations. So we try and keep it as quiet as possible, even when you're eating or when you're sort of, you know, flushing the toilet or something. You know, in the monks' quarters over here, you know, just in the middle of the night, we don't flush the toilets in case it might disturb someone. Maybe at 4 or 5 o'clock, then we can start flushing. Or last in the evening, maybe 9 or 10 o'clock or something. Just allow it to sort of build up for a little while. It doesn't really smell, and it saves water as well. So what happens there is that you're being very sensitive to the people around you. So you're not banging doors. You're not dropping things. Even when you close the door of your room, you do it very gently. And that is encouraging silence. I know in some monasteries where I stayed, they were so strict on that. If you made any noise, you were thrown out of the monastery. I mean, literally, no second chance. And that was actually quite fascinating, because the silence was so respected that people were silent. And once you got that silence outside, and you've got the comfortable seat, the quiet place, the silent place, this is the beginnings of the Anapanasati Sutta. The next thing you're supposed to do is to sit down on that comfortable chair and establish mindfulness. For those of you who've read that sutta and know it, for years monks were worrying about what it means, this word paramukha. It's supposed to be, their translation was, in front of you. But all that means, that's just an idiom in Pali. What you put in front of you, you put as important. You literally, let's put it another way, you make prominent. Prominent literally means to go in front. And this is actually what we mean here. To make the breath, or make mindfulness, sorry, prominent. Make it important. The main thing. You don't watch the breath yet. You just make mindfulness the most important thing. And understanding what mindfulness is the key to understanding how to begin meditation on the breath, and why it is that many people fail in that meditation process, because they don't establish mindfulness first of all, and they go on to the breath too soon. When you go on to the breath too soon, it's very hard for you to hold. You can't keep it in mind except through force, and that force just makes the mind more tense, which means the breath is harder to hold. And you get into this terrible restlessness, or sloth and torpor, or tension and fighting, and always getting frustrated. Please remember that the inevitable result of will is frustration. If you try and control your meditation, you won't succeed, you just get frustrated, because that always happens when we exercise our will. You may succeed for a while, but then the world will confound our plans, because nature doesn't go according to our designs. Because of that, all will eventually ends up in frustration. So if you've been frustrated in this retreat or in your life, it's only because you've been willing. Here, instead of going straight onto the breath, and the only way you can do it is through force, through will, and that just makes you frustrated. It doesn't work in the long term. We arouse mindfulness. Now, what is mindfulness? There are many stages of mindfulness, and I was mentioning a few of those yesterday. This powerful mindfulness where you just see the leaves on the tree or the flower, and it's amazing just how beautiful and how much you can see in there. When the day before it was just a flower, that's all. Your mindfulness has got powerful. But before it gets to that intensity of mindfulness, we're talking also about the quality of mindfulness, what it is. Mindfulness is about what's happening now. If you're off in the future or the past, you're just not here. You're not being mindful. The first quality of mindfulness is present moment awareness. If you're thinking about what you're going to do when I finish this talk, you're not listening to me, you're not being mindful, you're not here. If you're lingering about what happened earlier today, or who said what to whom, then you're not being mindful, you're not here, you're not engaging with reality. All the past and the future is a cop-out for mindfulness. So the first thing to notice, that mindfulness only exists in the present moment. And so by emphasizing present moment awareness, you're emphasizing the beginning of true mindfulness. As soon as you start thinking, planning, expecting, you're not being mindful. If in your meditation your thought comes up, what should I do next? You're not being mindful. What should I do next is about the future. You are neglecting what's happening now. The next doesn't exist. So just watch what's happening now. Any plans, right, I've been on the breath, now I can go on to something else, you're not being mindful. If you think, wow, this has been a terrible meditation, you're not being mindful. That's what's happened in the past. What is happening now? That's the only place where mindfulness exists. So to establish mindfulness, you have to establish the present moment. And the second part of mindfulness, if you're talking about the world, you're not listening to it. You're not really receiving the information. You're just living in the commentary world of thought and names and words. To be mindful, you also have to be silent. To be fully aware. If when I'm talking, you're thinking about something, or having a commentary, or having an argument, or worrying about something else, then you're not listening, you're not being mindful of these words. Mindfulness only comes from the place of silence. So when the Buddha mentioned establishing mindfulness at the beginning of the Anapanasati Sutta, I explain that, in my words, as becoming silent in the present moment. So the first task, the major thing you should be doing at the beginning, is subduing this mind's tendency to always run ahead of itself or linger in the past, and then to subdue the mind's habit of always giving things a name and having a conversation about everything, always giving your opinion about, you know, the matter which is before your consciousness. Instead, we train ourselves just to know what's happening now, and just to know it without giving it a name, without discussing it, without writing an essay on it. We just know it and leave it. That is the beginning of mindfulness. Once you start to do this, again, you need to recognize what I'm talking about, become familiar, become comfortable with it. You understand what mindfulness is. It's incredible how you can use that mindfulness in all aspects of your daily life. Whether it's your partner talking to you, you can really listen. In the moment, shut up. It's amazing what you can hear. You have a letter to write, shut up, be in the moment, you do it very quickly. You're not wasting time. You're not, your hand is writing a letter, but your mind is thinking about dinner. You can learn how to do one thing at a time. Be fully focused. Be silent and in the moment with the task at hand. And even if you're laying bricks, or you're going for an interview, or you're doing some program on your computer, with that degree of one point in this, in the moment, silence, you achieve so much more. It's the beginnings of meditation. Once you have established that mindfulness, then you can start to watch the breath, or the body, or do loving kindness, or whatever else you want to do in your meditation. Before then, the mind is not prepared. If any of you have ever done any painting in your home, you know that the most important part of painting is the preparation. To clean the wall, to fill the gaps, to take off all the flaking stuff. The preparation might take many hours, and the actual painting just a fraction of that time. But if you don't do the preparation, then you always get a terrible job. And the preparation in this meditation is so important that even on these 3 month retreats which I teach at my monastery, even there I spend so much emphasis on present moment awareness and silence. Present moment awareness and silence. Present moment awareness and silence. So people almost get sick of the word present moment awareness and silence. But I do that on purpose, because if you get that strong, then when you just want to watch the breath, it is so easy to do. The reason is because the two main obstacles to breath awareness have been taken away. Time and thought. Take those two away. No time, there's only this moment. It's easy. To demonstrate that, sometimes I do these little object lessons, these little tricks to make people laugh sometimes. I tell people to close your eyes and breathe in and out 3 times and then open your eyes at the end of the 3rd breath. And the novice meditators, they do that. They close their eyes, breathe in and out 3 times and they open their breath. Open their eyes. And then I say, was that easy? Yeah, everybody can do that. Now I tell them, close your eyes and now meditate for 3,000 breaths. And they laugh and say, that's impossible. What is the difference? No difference, it's just a concept makes it different. It's only one breath at a time. When we get rid of the time thing, it's easy to watch the breath. There's only one breath happening. But as soon as you take 3,000 breaths, you're not watching the breath now. You're worried about the 2,999 breaths which are ahead of you. That is a problem. You think, oh, I can't do that. And it's just a matter of perception, that's all. And this is what happens in our meditation. So how many hours have I got left? How many minutes have I got left to meditate? We start worrying. My meditation's terrible because what's happened so far? That's just being imprisoned by the past. If you're in the present moment, meditation is so easy. You're just watching this breath happening now. That's all you've got. What is the problem? There is no problem. If you stop thinking, what is the problem? It's a good meditation, a bad meditation. That's more thinking. It's measuring. Stop it. You're just watching the breath in silence and in the moment. Then you're sweet. That's all you need to do. The breath becomes so easy to watch. You don't have to hold it. It's there. So by putting present moment awareness and silence at the beginning, establishing mindfulness, the Buddha was saying, get it right first of all, make the preparation, then once you watch the breath, it's easy to do. And to running through those stages of anapanasati, yes, watch the breath long or short, in or out, who cares, as long as you know it's happening. That's just giving it a little bit of interest. Just so you're not just watching an ordinary breath, you just give it, you know, watch some aspect of it. It doesn't have to be long, it doesn't have to be short, it can be in the middle. It can be rough, it can be smooth, it can be something else. Just give a little bit of commentary. Just to make it a bit more interesting. Instead of letting go of all the descriptions straight away, you just keep one or two which is connected with the breath, which is why sometimes I ask people to make a little picture around the breath. You know, my favorite one is to think of the breath like this energy which is coming out from the garden outside, because the oxygen comes from all the green stuff in the garden, the grass, the flowers, the trees. And they're giving you the gift of life. they're giving the oxygen, they're re-oxygenating the air for you. So every time you breathe in a gift from nature. And when you breathe out, your waste material is a carbon dioxide. That goes to the plants, because that's what they take in. So you give a gift back to nature. And every breath comes from the flowers. Every breath out builds the trees. Wow. I'm at one with nature. It just makes it interesting. See, breathing in, you can just imagine these little flowers lining up to give you dana. Here, take some oxygen. And then you can imagine yourself giving this wonderful gift to nature so the trees will be healthy. Make it a little bit of a picture, and then it makes it interesting. It involves you. Instead of just watching the breath go in, breath go out, breath go in, breath go out. At the beginning, it's difficult to do. So you can make it your own little picture. The other one which I do, I sometimes look upon the breath like sitting on the beach, just watching the waves go in and the waves go out. That's like the breath, this wave of air coming into your body, like the surf on a beach washing up into your lungs. And then the waves just go out again, ebbing away. This flow of life backwards and forwards from your body, like sitting on the beach watching the waves. And that has a good advantage, because I know that I cannot control those waves. I cannot make those waves come in faster or slower. It belongs to the nature of the ocean. I can't control those waves. They're big, they're small, I can wish for whatever I want, but all my wishing will not have any effect on either the size or the speed of those waves coming in onto the shore. Same with my breath. I just like the waves, it doesn't belong to me. I just watch them washing up and washing away. And I make a little picture like that. That's exactly the same meaning as the Buddha said, watch long breaths and short breaths. Just give it a little picture to make it interesting, to involve the mind a little bit more. For those of you who are accountants, you can try counting the breath, which is another way of making it interesting. However, don't do this for too long, otherwise you'll screw up your mind. And sooner or later you'll get these little calculators out. Because what I do is I count when the breath goes in, one, out one, in two, out two, in three, out three, in four, out four. People love this little method just because it gives them something solid they can do, something they can grasp onto, something their ego can play with. But anyhow, I still teach it. In four, out four, in five, out five, in six, in seven, out eight, in nine, out nine. Then start again at one. In one, out one, two, two, three, three, four, four, five, five, six, seven, seven, in eight, out eight. Just up to eight this time. The next time, in one, out one, in two, out two, three, three, four, four, five, five, six, in seven, out seven. Now to seven. And in one, out one, in two, out two, in three, out three, in four, out four, in five, out five, in six, out six. Just a six. In one, out one, in two, out two, in three, out three, in four, out four, in five, out five. Just a five. In one, out one, in two, out two, in three, out three, in four, out four, up to four. In one, out one, in two, out two, in three, out three, and in one, out one, in two, out two, and last of all, in one, out one. A whole cycle of 45 breaths. That just gives you something to do, something to play with. The mind is happy. At last, Ajahn Brahma has given me something I can measure myself with and feel great about and build up my ego. Yeah, I've done it. But the trouble is, what many of you will find is you lose your mindfulness. You find yourself saying, in 13, out 13, in 14, out 14. You just keep on going because your mind is another place. So what that actually does is, usefulness is actually to show you just how mindful you are, because you have to really be on the ball. Or sometimes you don't know where you are. In six, out six. Isn't it middle of the 7-1 or the 8-1? I don't know where I am. If that's the case, stop, go back to the beginning. It just actually shows, but it gives you something to do, something to play with. But don't do it for hour after hour after hour, otherwise you'll stuff up your brain, no end, and you'll need to go into the Panadol. So just play with it for a little while. And that's just a great time when you can try the backwards stuff. instead of in one, out one, out one, in one, out two, in two, out three, in three, out four, in four. Just play, it's good fun. See what happens. Now the point is, it's just making the breath interesting until that you can just hold the breath. You don't need to say in or out, just watching the breath, and that becomes nice and calm. Just watch the breath go in, watch the breath go out, in, out, in, out, seeing what they call the whole breath. And the whole breath means from the very beginning of an in-breath. Can you just watch from the very beginning, right until the end? And after the breath is finished, there's always a pause before the in-breath, before the out-breath begins. The out-breath goes out, and it stops. And you wait until the body needs more oxygen, and you breathe in again. You see, the whole process of breath, no longer just in and out, but a whole process, not just day and night, but to see the dawns and the sunrise and the sun rising to its zenith and then falling back down to the horizon again, and then the twilight, the darkness grow, and then the middle of the night when the stars come out and the early morning glow on the eastern horizon as you see the sun begin to go again. There's a whole process of day and night. In the same way, there's a whole process of in and out breaths. You see the whole sequence of moments called one in-breath, and the whole sequence of moments called the out-breath. What you're doing here is you're filling the mind completely with the meditation object. So every moment of consciousness is just aware of the breath. Now, to be able to do that, the breath has to start to be fun. You can't force yourself. This is a stage which usually best happens naturally. You're just watching the breath go in and out. As you settle down, you see more of the breath. As you see more of the breath, it starts to fill up all of the vacant spaces in your mind. You're just watching the complete breath. When that happens, it's the nature, this is where the process begins to work in spite of you. Okay, you can do the counting, you can actually take up the breath. Those are places where you can do something without really spoiling what's happening. But the deeper you get in meditation, the less you can do. Every little bit of action in the deeper stages of the meditation really disturbs. So you're just watching the whole breath go in and out. It starts to get beautiful. This is where the joy starts to come up, and this is one of the most important stages of meditation. You're just watching the breath go in and out, and it becomes fun, real fun. You're enjoying it, you're having a great time. The breath becomes beautiful. You just want to watch it, you just want to be with it. When that happens to meditators, it makes me happy, because you've got deep enough, I can let you go now, and you're just enjoying yourself. I can't stop you. You just want to meditate more and more. You're having a good time. And the Buddha called this, it's when the arising of piti sukha coming up in meditation. If you want to do anything at this stage, just look for the happiness. Happiness is there with the meditation. But the opposite is when we develop, and this is one of the key words in meditation, we develop the fault-finding mind. Know that fault-finding mind? What it is you see, oh, the cushions are too hard, or the floor is too hard, the beds are just too short, the rooms are just too narrow, the food is too much, or it's too cold, or it's too hot. Whatever it is, you always find some faults in it. The Buddha, he was too enlightened. Whatever it is, you can always find fault in anything you want. And that is the nature of many people's minds. They can't become content for their whole life. They've got a husband, they look for the faults in that husband. They've got a job, look for the faults in it. And you're very good at that. You can see faults in anything. Now the point is that if you develop that fault-finding mind in this meditation, you're stuffed. What happens? You get this breath, it's not good enough, it's boring, it's easy to find faults in it, but stop all of that. Don't look for the faults, look for the beauty. Look for the beauty in the breath. Look for the beauty in this food. Just how people, especially Bianca, has lovingly cooked this food. She's done the very best she can. She's not getting paid for this. She's just doing it as for her dana, cooking for all of you. For this, it's supposed to be a holiday time. We look upon that and say, wow, I don't care, you know, what's in that food. Where it comes from makes that really beautiful and delicious. You don't look if a person's ugly or if they're, you know, very beautiful. They've got this incredible, beautiful heart. That's good enough for me. They could be deformed with boils and pimples, with a crooked nose, with only one eye, and with holes in their teeth. I don't care. They've got this just wonderful character. They're beautiful. So you don't look for fault finding. You look for all the wonderful things which are there. Our Buddhist Society of WA, a bunch of amateurs, but they've got such wonderful hearts. Oh, they're so amazing. I really love them all. So if you look upon it as like fault finding, you just, nothing is ever good for you. Imagine going to heaven with a fault finding mind. This white clothes all the time. Can't we have some just fun clothes? Harp music. Can't we have some Jimi Hendrix? Ambrosia all the time. Is there a fish and chip shop up in heaven? I don't know. But whatever, if you're fault-finding mind, you can never have happiness anywhere. It's important with your meditation, when you get to that stage of the breath, have a mind which tends to look for the happiness. It's fascinating that once, this is years ago, the first time I went to visit England, I think Ajahn Sumedho was, this was actually before I came here, just 1 year before I came to Australia, I went to visit my family in England. And Ajahn Sumedho had just been there just about one year. And as soon as I came there, he said, right, we're not letting you go. Unfortunately, Ajahn Chah called me back. He probably had other plans for me. But at the time, Ajahn Sumedho was really trying to sort of take me around and trying to sort of suck me into staying with him in England. And I remember one place he took me, he was teaching a retreat in the town of Doncaster in the north of England. Doncaster is a coal mining town. We went there on the weekend, and people were surprised and said, on the weekend, everybody leaves Doncaster. No one comes to Doncaster on a weekend. It was this grimy, sort of black, coal mining, depressed town in the north of England. So after the first day of the retreat, we had a walk in the morning, and you know, went out for a walk with Ajahn Sumedho, went to the park and see the rose gardens and all these places, sort of places. We got similar characters. When we came back and our host said, oh, where did you go for a walk? He said, I went to the gardens, saw the flowers, there's a beautiful church over there. And yeah, that's typical of you guys. Because the week before, about a month before, another monk had given a retreat, and he was one of these depressive guys. When he went for a walk, he went to the gas works, to the old, dirty old canal, and all the industrial areas. And that's just where he gravitates to. And you can see, if you've got a fault-finding mind, that's actually, you just go straight to the sort of the industrial toxic waste dumps. But if you've got this other positive mind, you just look for the flowers and the gardens and the beautiful stuff. Now you can understand what I'm talking about here. When you meditate, which places do you go to visit? Do you go and visit the toxic waste dumps of your mind? All those things which happened to you in the past? Or do you actually go looking for the happiness and the bliss? And that's the difference between the positive mind and the fault-finding mind. So this stage of the meditation, when you get to the breath, be very careful of that fault-finding mind, which is looking for what's wrong. And go for the positive side of it. This is wonderful. You're free. You don't have to do anything. You've got this breath there. It's great. I just don't have to do any cooking. I don't have to talk. I don't have to meet anybody's expectations. I'm completely free, and I've just got only one thing I need to look at, and this is breath. I'm so simple, and everything else, all the complications of my life are gone. This is bliss. This is great. Yeah. That's what those of you who came for the chanting this morning, that's what I said after the chanting. So when you get up in the morning, doesn't matter what time it is, jump out of the bed, Sippity doodah, I'm on retreat. Hooray! Great. I don't have to go to work today. Got no husband, no telephone calls, no emails. Wow, marvellous. All I've got to do all day is meditate, watch the breath, having a great time. This is amazing. Wow, sippity doodah, yeah, go for it. Now, can you do that at 4 o'clock in the morning? It's wonderful when you can do that. You've got to get up anyway. So you give it this beautiful fun. You're not looking at this, ugh, hour after hour meditation. Oh, yesterday was so tough. That's what you start to do. You start off your day with thought fighting, and it's going to carry on all day. So you go in that positive state of mind, and then, if that's what you do when you first get up in the morning, then when the breath comes up, oh, wow, this beautiful breath. Oh, this is so nice, so lovely. You see its beauty. And this becomes the most important stage in the meditation, I keep on saying. When the breath starts to become beautiful, when the meditation becomes joyful. And then you just sit there, you don't worry about time, because you're enjoying every moment. It becomes so delicious and so delectable. Just watching your breath, you don't want anything else in the whole world. You don't need anything else, fully satisfied, absolutely content. Moments pass in absolute peace, contentment. It's not absolute, but it's good enough, peace, contentment, joy. Because you do that, we get the snowball effect. Because you're enjoying the breath, you don't have to put any more effort in. There's no struggle. The mind is not restless because it doesn't want to go anywhere. It's happy, it's content, it wants to be here. Once it wants to be here, you don't put any effort in at all. That makes the joy even more intense. As I said yesterday, it is the struggle which stops the joy arising. You give up that struggle, you let go, you make peace, and the energies of the mind build and build and build. And the energy of the mind is called happiness, bliss. The mind just starts to get more and more happy. You're sitting there watching, you don't want to move. You can't feel the body, you're just having too much fun. You're just enjoying the breath. And as that breath gets more and more delicious, the delicious, the bliss gets so strong that the breath disappears. If you can get the bliss coming up at that stage, you're doing really, really well. The breath will disappear. And when it disappears, you don't have to worry what to look at. You've got the bliss, the joy to look at. And that bliss and joy will soon turn into this beautiful light in the mind, which I'll talk about later. If, though, that you're watching the breath and it disappears, and there's not enough bliss for anyone, what am I supposed to watch? Either you let go of the breath too early, or you never actually developed enough happiness in the first place, probably because you've been controlling too much already. So when you've got the breath, make the breath really nice, really delicious. That's what I mentioned yesterday, that time my Gajahn Ganha would always say, just breathe in, sabai. Breathe out, sabai. You can even do that now. Just breathe in the most sensuous, delicious, wonderful, delightful breath you could possibly breathe in. Go and do it. Oh, that's nice. And breathe out the most wonderful, joyful out-breath you've ever done. Oh. So you can do that. You can make the breath delicious. So do that at that particular stage of the meditation. You're just watching the breath go in and out. And if it's dull and boring, put a bit of zest into it, a bit of joy. That is interfering. That is doing something. But as I was saying, it's only a very subtle form of doing. If that doesn't work, there's another trick which you can do. And it's a very effective but very simple trick to get a bit more joy in the meditation. Remember, at this point you've got your eyes closed, you're watching the breath go in and go out. For a few seconds, take your attention away from the breath and pull it on your face and smile. When you smile, the mind also smiles. And then you quickly go back to your breath and you find the breath is more beautiful. The breath is just the breath. The beauty is what we add onto it. So in the middle of the meditation, if you've got no happiness coming, put a few, maybe 2-3 seconds at most, onto your face, smile. smile, and then the mind brightens up, and then leave the face and go back to the breath. It works, it's a nice thing to do. Brings a little bit of happiness into the meditation. Right, then the Buddha said this anapanasati, once you get to that stage of the beautiful breath, I spent most of this talk talking just about that. The beautiful breath is having a wonderful time, the snowball effect, the breath disappears, this beautiful light comes up in the mind. Just leave the light alone, don't get excited, remember, let it go. Disengage, none of my business, it's just passing through, don't hold on to it. It's not yours, so it's nothing to do with you. Don't get involved in what's not your business. When a nimitta comes up and you start getting involved, it's like going into the kitchen and telling Bianca how to cook a dinner. She'll throw you out, because it's not your job to tell, you know, what you want for dinner today, what you want for lunch today. That's, oh, she's the cook, let her do it. Your job is just do the eating. That's when you always need two people for a meal. One to do the cooking, one to do the eating. So for my life, I volunteer to be the one who's doing the eating. So I do my share. But anyhow, so it's none of your business going into the kitchen. The same when this nimitta comes up. It's none of your business to control it, to say it should come up this way or that way, faster, slower, brighter, whatever. None of your business. Get your hands away. Stop interfering. So when you can just leave it alone like that, just the nimitta just grows by itself. It's beautiful, delicious, and it just stays there. And then you just enter the nimitta, get into these jhanas, and have a wonderful time. This is all described in the Anapanasati Sutta. You just have to know what the words mean. When it says rising joy, developing joy, calming that mind, experiencing the, so there was the mental formation, which is the bliss, calming that mental formation, experiencing the jitta, the mind, that's the nimitta when that comes up. Sort of, they say, abhipamojyang jitang, which is like brightening up that nimitta, just allowing it to become more and more delicious, more and more beautiful. And then calming that nimitta, in other words, sustaining it so it's not moving. And then freeing the mind is entering the jhana. As the 12 stages of anapanasati, the stages afterwards are what happens when you come out of the jhanas. And just one last word. For those of you who still think that Ajahn Brahm teaches samatha and he does not teach vipassana, for those of you who think that satipatthana is the right way, again and again, the Buddha stated, this is not Ajahn Brahm's words, it's the Buddha's words, anyone who completes the stages of Anapanasati also completes, by that practice, also completes the four Satipatthanas. The four Satipatthanas are Anapanasati. Anapanasati is the four Satipatthanas. That's the word of the Buddha, not the word of a monk. So if you practice this best meditation, at the same time you are doing satipatthana meditation. There is no difference. That's the word of the Buddha, not me. I can read it out to you. Anapanasati Sutta or Anapanasati Sanghita, there it is. Anyone who completes the 16 stages of Anapanasati has also completed the four satipatthanas. So you don't need to think, I'll do Anapanasati, then I'll do Satipatthana. You're doing it at the same time. This is called efficiency. I would say killing two birds with one stone, but that's not a very good Buddhist metaphor. But this is what's happening. So, just get into it. Practice. Now I've given you some nice guidelines, something to do. And you think, oh, at last, happy, and now I know where I am. I got, okay, present moment awareness, and now I get to silence, and I'm going to watch the breath, and I watch the whole breath. Where am I today? Today I'm going to go for the whole breath. Yeah, go for that one. And set yourself these terrible goals, and you stuff yourself up again. Now, you see the danger here, when you give these little stages. When you give the stages, you get desire and craving, control, and now you get frustration when you don't get as far as you want. Or you get, hey, I can do it at last, when you do get somewhere. All of those, it just feeds the ego and stops you going further. be careful. The best teaching is what I've already given on the first night. Sit there, do nothing. If that's not enough for you, sit there. Okay, find a comfortable seat. Count the breath, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. Do something. And that just, after a while, just stop doing it. If you can't stop doing it straight away, then stop in status. And see what happens. It's not up to you. It's just going to happen naturally. You're building up the peace. It's not going to happen today. You're just only starting. Just allow it just develop. And after a while, the hours, the days go by. You just get peaceful. And you get blissed out. That's fun. But if you want to get there quicker and get deeper, then do nothing sooner. The earlier you give up all this striving, the quicker you'll get to the goal. Okay? Anapanasati, not Anapanasati. So anyone got any questions about Anapanasati? About meditation on the breath? It's all quite clear. Okay, well, enjoy yourself. Have fun. No fault-finding mind. Play around a bit. Sit in a different way. Sit back to front. Meditate back to front. Sit maybe with your hands on your head, or one hand up here, one hand up there. Have some really weird hand movements or whatever. Just enjoy it. Make it a bit more fun. Don't get bored because you're a robot. Okay, now we're going to have the interviews.